It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In recent weeks, sales of the novel 1984 by George Orwell, first published in 1949, have been soaring. It climbed to the top of the Amazon.com bestseller list, and bookstores report that copies are flying off the shelves. Since so many people are reading or rereading it right now, we're going to spend the hour talking about what makes this classic relevant in 2017. And my first guest today turns his classroom into a totalitarian state every year around the end of October. Andrew Simmons is an English teacher at San Rafael High School in San Rafael, California, the San Francisco Bay Area. He teaches 1984 to high school seniors. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for being here. And how do you turn your classroom into a totalitarian state? What do you do?
What I usually do is I gradually transition the classroom environment into a totalitarian state towards the end of the student's personal statement for college application unit. So they're writing their personal statements, and I sort of make an announcement that there's been a lot of senioritis. And so I say there's been a lot of senioritis, and students are coming in late and not turning in work. And I usually blame one class for the problem, right? If I have three classes, each class gets blamed for it once. But, you know, each class is under the impression that the problem is mostly with a different class and not them. So I demonize another class, and, you know, I lay out this new platform for improving school culture that essentially requires students to monitor one another. And so I secretly assign the name of a student to each student, and they have to complete regular reports about the behavior and academic activities of that student, and bring them regularly to class and turn them into me. So I'm collecting the reports. I make rules, class rules, stricter progressively. So every day that students arrive in class, there's usually a new rule that I present, not as a rule, but as an opportunity, right? Example might be no more bathroom breaks, right? Because we need to spend more time in class because of all the alarming academic issues that I'm seeing. And then, I make posters, and we put up posters all over school, and I carpet my classroom in posters. So students are constantly bombarded with the platform. And over time, you know, after a couple of weeks of that, I sort of shift the focus of the class less on dealing with the problem of academic issues and more on me. I just start putting up posters of my face, and there are fewer words and less in the way of encouragement about, you know, students doing their part academically and encouraging others to be better students. And it's more just sort of, you know, trust in Simmons. Simmons knows.
And at what point in this process do you introduce the book 1984?
We usually start reading 1984 a couple of weeks into it, but I don't immediately announce to them that we're reading a work of dystopian literature that, you know, portrays a totalitarian state and the struggle of an individual to be human and to find freedom within that state. I don't really set that up explicitly for them. I just say we're going to read a, you know, interesting book from a long time ago by a guy named George Orwell. And then we start reading it without really understanding that what they're experiencing is designed to simulate the experience of a character in the story.
So at what point do students first realize what's going on?
Well, some of them realize pretty quickly because I change it a little bit every year, but it's sort of popular, and so they hear from their friends that we're a little bit older, that they're doing this weird thing in their senior class. And so they kind of know what it is, but that makes it even more interesting because they see it coming, and they sort of think it's funny, and they participate, they do what they're told, they write reports about classmates. Some of them write really good reports. You know, I've had girlfriends if someone's in a relationship with another student I teach, I usually assign them one another to see if they'll rat each other out for things. They usually do. And to answer your question, most students know that it's for fun, but they are still either annoyed by it or they are still pretty much good soldiers, right? Very few students actually do rebel in any sort of coherent way. And certainly even those who rebel in a coherent way, rarely I have a student who does. It's not a unified front. It's nothing sustained, and it's nothing that ever threatens to sort of destabilize what I've created.
When the experiment comes to an end and the students have read this book and hopefully understand the book and then think about what they've done, how do the students react?
Well, usually what happens is at the end of the book, we've already had this conversation. I usually do the post-mortem on my simulation maybe about a third of the way through the book. So I don't make it last through the whole book because I want to get to the point where they know what this book is about, and they are being encouraged to look to current events and look to more recent history and to basically constantly ask themselves, is this some strange prediction that never came true? Is this a warning that people haven't really heeded? Do we live in a society that on certain mornings when we wake up feels a little bit like the one that the book presents to us? We had that conversation, you know, from about a third of the book to the end of the book. But when we have a postmortem, what's very interesting is I typically declare an end to the totalitarian state. I say the simulation, this is over, right? What was it about? What was I trying to teach you? What was the point of it? And most of them say, yes, you're trying to teach us about what a totalitarian state is. So they get that. And many of them think that I was actually trying to improve the grades of seniors, which is funny. And I always joke, well, you know, I gave up hope. I joke about that. But, you know, and I also joke with some seriousness that a totalitarian state would probably improve their grades if they actually were terrified about failing and someone really was spying on them constantly and recording their activities. I mean, that was the case, is that, you know, you have to understand that at the end of this, I have a 9 to 12 inch high stack of reports that students have filed about one another. So I do actually have the information that would be very useful if I wanted to talk to the administration about specific students' work habits and, you know, why their grades are what they are. So that's kind of an interesting side note. And I make sure to make that clear to them that I did get the information that might benefit me if I wanted to have that level of control. But they don't really get that it's a test of them. They understand that it's a test of this sort of, you know, I'm simulating the dystopian mood of the book and teaching about totalitarian states. They don't get that it's a test of their sort of character and their critical thinking and how well can they rebel. I should have prefaced this. I've tied their grade to this. So they get points based on completing reports and participation in the classroom activities. So they're worried they will fail the class, which, of course, they can't. For this reason, but I convince them that they can fail the class if they don't participate well. And so that's how I get them to buy in. But it is a test of their character. Will they rebel? Will they be loyal to one another over prioritizing, points in the grade book? Will they realize that I can't really fail them all? And if they just refuse to do what they're being told to do, that they'll end up winning. No, it's never happened. It's never, ever happened. Now, individuals, yes, and they usually get mad when I say that I was testing you and you failed, you know. And they usually get mad and say, we weren't really taking that seriously. We know that you were messing with us. And I say, okay, well, when will you take it seriously? You can pretty easily convince yourself that the stuff going on in your world is above your head and there's nothing you can do about it. And your world can change past point of repair if citizens don't exercise their critical thinking skills and stand up for themselves.
This year, we know that you do this in your classroom because you wrote a piece for The Atlantic this fall, and your 1984 unit took place during the U.S. presidential election. And you're in a very diverse school, many Hispanic students in your school. How was it different this year?
The general mood of the of my school, and I think many schools in that are diverse, has been a little more anxious. And there was a walkout at school in mid-November, and there have been some sort of protests, and some students have been very active in participating in those. I believe that students very quickly connected the book to the current political mood in the country. And I had them do that in the form of a research inquiry assignment where I gave them a couple of threads to pull and said, you have to write a response paper in which you connect one of these five themes in the book to events happening in our society today. Can you do it? And if you can't do it, explain why you can't. And if you can do it, explain why you can't. So they had to find articles, and they did a fantastic job with that. And many, you know, I teach in Marin County, so it's quite liberal, but there are students who don't hold particularly liberal beliefs, and we're pretty happy about the election results. So there was a little bit of class dispute in that discussion forum about the degree to which the new president, the president-elect, at the time the president-elect, and his promised policies and his methods, his campaign tactics, echoed the mood of 1984. And so, to answer your question in a shorter way that maybe you'll prefer to edit this down to, is that it felt extremely relevant to students. And it felt very much, while we were in the middle of it, like the right book to be reading for this moment.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Wonderful talking to you.
Andrew Simmons is an English teacher at San Rafael High School in the San Francisco Bay Area. He teaches 1984 to his high school seniors every year. This was his third year of teaching the book. We're going to continue our conversation about 1984 in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Ever since it was published in 1949, George Orwell's 1984 has repeatedly jumped onto the bestseller lists. It's a cautionary tale that seems to find new relevance and resonance every few years. Once again, it is topping bestseller lists, and we're spending the hour looking at what 1984 can tell us in 2017. We also want to hear from you this hour. If you've recently picked up 1984, maybe for the first time, maybe again, we'd love to hear your thoughts. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. For those who haven't read the book takes place in 1984, which was a vision of the future, of course. The reader experiences the world through the main character, Winston Smith, who tries to defy the all-powerful government of Big Brother in his nation-state of Oceania. The book takes place in what used to be England. This is a world with no personal freedom and no privacy. The party slogans are war is peace, freedom is slavery, and ignorance is strength. This is a world where the party controls all information, including the ability to rewrite history. There are no books, there is no art, and even personal relationships are controlled by the party. Here this hour to talk with me about 1984 and its relevance in 2017 is Glenn Penny. He's a history professor at the University of Iowa. He's teaching 1984 to one of his classes this semester. Hello, Glenn.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
We also have with us Michael Bougea. He is director and professor of ISU's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication. He also just received the Iowa Newspaper Association's highest honor, the Distinguished Service Award, for his work in journalism education. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Charity. Glad to be on.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And Glenn, I want to start with you. You're a history professor, so help us put this into historical context a little bit. The book was published in 1949, of course, in the wake of World War II. Help us understand why that book was published at that moment.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with Orwell's relationship to the Spanish Civil War, totalitarianism, communism, fascism, and the fact that the war was over, but a lot of the concerns that had been raised by them weren't gone. And he was pondering them, and he wrote about them. So a lot of the things you see in here are the pageantry of political parties, the control of information, the way to actually control discourse, the way people talk about things, to create slogans so that you no longer have to think, and to control education. You know, back in the age of the Enlightenment, Immanuel Kant and others said that knowledge is power. And he understood that, and that's why there's a lot in the book about education and ignorance and maintaining control.
And there's an original afterword of the book that points out that if you are reading this book as merely a statement about Nazism or Stalinist communism, you're missing the point. This wasn't just about those regimes, right?
Right. It's not a reflection on the past. This actually has a lot to do with his concern about the present. That's, I think, why there's a good bit in here about nuclear weapons and control of vast empires. And he's living in a world in which, you're dividing up the world into two great superpowers. He has three in his book. But I think his interest is the present. It's not just the past.
Well, and Michael, you are on this program today, I mean, partially because you are a professor of journalism, but also because because 1984 is one of your very favorite books of all time. So what is it that speaks to you so strongly in this book?
Well, I read it in high school, and something stuck with me for so long, and it's a statement that Winston Smith makes, and it is, "I understand how, but I don't understand why." And, maybe it was middle school that I read it, but the fact of the matter is that helped propel me into journalism, because journalists were, during the Watergate era, struggling to understand why. And I think that question, more now than ever, is not being answered.
The book, as I mentioned, springs to the top of bestseller lists not infrequently. The last time it had a major spike was in 2013. And in 2013, the concern was about privacy, because that was when we started understanding the National Security Agency and the extent of surveillance that is possible. I know that kind of technology has been something that you've been interested in your career. And over the years, that seems to be the main thing that people turn to 1984 for, is this idea of spying on people and invasion of privacy. The world that 1984 envisioned in that way, of course, has not entirely come to pass. But do you find that to be a very relevant part of the book?
Yeah, it is relevant, but there are other dystopia books that are relevant, too. You can't just look to 1984. I think you have to look to 1984 in context with Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. And I think, the collective consciousness, when we talk about 1984, looks to Snowden and government surveillance. But I think Aldous Huxley in Brave New World really puts his finger on what we have now. Many of your listeners have in their possession, very near them, or even in their hand right now, mobile devices. And they're on Facebook or Twitter. They spend hours on it. I think the latest statistic was 11 hours per day looking at a computer screen. And, in Brave New World, the surveillance is done without anyone really knowing about it. I pulled a quote here from Brave New World. It says, "A really efficient totalitarian state would be one in which the all-powerful executive of political bosses control a population of slaves who do not have to be coerced because they love their servitude." Well, the servitude that we have now is to the machine and to our mobile devices. There are many things about 1984, however, that are true and that we should be aware of. What are the goals of the government, the Big Brother, in 1984? That they were trying to achieve was the ability to read the minds of millions of people simultaneously. You know what? They can do that now, based on all the data mining that goes into your social media use and your computer use.
Right now, at this moment, people are turning to 1984. I think not so much because of the idea of this technology and the idea of this surveillance, but because of the idea of alternative facts, which is a phrase that we have heard, from Kellyanne Conway, spokesperson for President Trump. And Glenn, I mean, that this is one of the things that led you to be teaching this book right in this moment.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing is, whenever I teach the history of Western civilization, I have tons of students who are taking the class because they have to. And one of my goals is to teach them why history is important, how history is used. And I do it through a whole lot of examples. And in the end, I end with an Orwell quote where I talk about whoever controls the present controls the past. And if you control the past, you control the future. How do you use the past? How do you rewrite the past to legitimate the future that you want? And, you know, the rhetoric alternative facts is it's tragic as well as comic. I mean, my wife grew up in East Germany, and the first time she heard it, she just smiled and said, yes, I know all about alternative facts. I grew up under a totalitarian system. And this is the thing. It was really difficult for me to not teach this book because sitting through the election cycle, I'm not sure how many people didn't think of it. It was so obvious that you had an effort to rewrite history as discussions were taking place.
Well, and in the book, I mean, that is actually the main character's job, Winston Smith. He rewrites history all the time. He goes back and alters newspapers. Yeah. He gets these. And, of course, it's never framed as you are rewriting history, but he gets these missives that say there was a misprint or there was an article about a person who doesn't actually exist, and you need to correct the historical record. I mean, Michael, this is certainly something that's resonating with people right now.
Oh, yes, it is. You know, the biggest freedom that is articulated in 1984 is this, to say that 2 + 2 = 4. This is the struggle that Winston goes through during the torture phase of the book, which is really quite brutal, in which the antagonist O'Brien tries to get him to say 2 + 2 = 5.
And but it's not enough to just say that 2 + 2 = 5.
You got to believe it.
Right?
You have to believe it, and that's the concept of what Orwell called doublethink. Now let's connect doublethink with Kellyanne Conway's alternative facts, because it's really frightening. And doublethink is the ability, according to Orwell in the book, to hold two contradictory ideas in one's mind simultaneously. Now, that's what's going on in many corners of the media right now. And we do make a distinction at the Greenlee School between media, which is everything, social networks and newspapers and television, and journalism, which is the practice of disseminating to audience fact and analysis. And, you know, 1984 does speak quite eloquently about this.
Let's go to the phones, and we'd love to hear from you if you've recently picked up 1984, or maybe you just have a good memory of it from when you read it in high school. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. Why have you been looking back at this work right in this moment? 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Rihanna's on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Rihanna.
Hi. Sorry. Let me just come to the phone here. There was two comments I have to make. One is, years ago, I actually listened to a lecture by Schumacher, who wrote Small is Beautiful. And one of the comments that he made, which I think is very relevant to this conversation and to what's going on in the world today, is he was saying that when change happens, it happens incrementally, little piece, little step by little step by little step. And then you get to a point in change where you've gotten to a particular place, and the place where you've started and everything in between is kind of erased. I remember his example was specifically in terms of how trains change. But the point is that it's difficult to go back to where you started once you've done the erasure of everything in between. And we've come a long ways in terms of, in our world today, of getting rid of a lot of our freedoms, of undermining democracy, of corporations taking over the running of the government, of people's thoughts changing, where this whole discussion about alternative facts, you have to actually work at with a lot of people getting to understand that instead of it being an automatic aha. And I think that whole dynamic is important to look at and to become aware of. You know, how are we incrementally getting rid of our freedoms and our democracy and how we think and what our values are or what our values used to be? That's the first comment. The second is a question. I don't know the history of Orwell and how he came to write 1984. And my question is, was it partially based on having got, because it was written after World War II, was it partially based on the fascism in Europe and Germany, and then taking the understanding about the fascism and how it grew in the 1930s?
Well, and Rihanna, let me give Glenn an opportunity to respond to that, because we did already say that it was a reaction to World War II, although it was more than that.
Right. It's a reaction to recognizing that societies can be organized and controlled, manipulated through flows of information. On the one hand, one of the interesting things about the book is the people who are trying to be convinced to speak and think in certain ways are those people who are in the inner and outer party. There's this vast group of people they call the proletariat or the proles who are generally being ignored. They're manipulated and used, but the goal there is to simply keep them as ignorant as possible and let them do as they please. And there's a lot of that that's concerning Orwell as well. It's not just that he's worried about pageantry and goose-stepping and military power and the constant state of war in order to legitimate everything. It's also the general people that he's hoping can be convinced to act. But the fact of the matter is this notion that freedom lies in the hand of the proletariat, this isn't new from Orwell. This is something that Karl Marx was arguing about the 19th century.
Well, and it's quite an indictment from Orwell as well about people's lack of interest in the world around them. The proles in 1984 seem to be content with their lot.
Right. You give them enough amusements. They don't have to be great, but they're good enough. It's sort of like the Romans with bread and circus. Or to get back to the cell phone, right? You give people enough sort of misinformation, little slogans, little sound bites, and they don't actually inquire anymore. And that, I think, is the saddest part of the book.
Michael, you want to weigh in on that?
First of all, I agree with all that. I pulled out a letter about why Orwell wrote 1984, and he said, all national movements everywhere, even those that originate in resistance to German domination, seem to take non-democratic forms to group them around some superhuman Führer, Hitler, Stalin, Salazar, Franco, and to adopt the theory that the end justifies the means. But there's other things in 1984 that are really chilling. Before I came to Iowa State University, I worked for 17 years at Ohio University, which is in the Appalachian Mountain regions right near West Virginia. And there's a description of proles in the book that actually can you can identify that still exists today in many places in Appalachia and Mississippi and so forth. You know, it says proles were forced to work in the coal mines. So long as they continued to work and breed, their other activities were out without importance, heavy physical work, the care of home and children, petty quarrels with neighbors. And then he goes on about gambling. And, of course, the lottery is a big point in 1984. The proles keep playing the lottery. No one ever wins the big riches, but just enough to keep people playing. And when you take a look at this, when he talks about the lifespan of the proles, you know, West Virginia is number 49 out of 50, with Mississippi being the only one lower about the lifespan. You know, this country still does have, what Glenn was saying, pockets that George Orwell was very concerned about. But there is also something very frightening that George Orwell says to this point. He says, until, they're talking about the proles, until they become conscious, they will never rebel. And until after they have rebelled, they cannot become conscious. Now, if you think about that for a little bit, it's a truly chilling thought.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about the book 1984. It was published in 1949 by George Orwell, and just in the last couple of weeks, it has jumped again to the top of bestseller lists. Online bookstores are seeing the book fly off their shelves. The publisher is ordering a reprint right now. So we're spending the hour talking about this book and what it can tell us in 2017. With me, Michael Bougea. He's director and professor of Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication, and Glenn Penny, a history professor at the University of Iowa. You can join us as well, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are looking back at the classic novel 1984 by George Orwell that was published in 1949. We're talking about what this novel that paints a picture of a world under totalitarian regimes, a world that is constantly at war, a world without personal freedom, where facts are meaningless. We're taking a look at what that can tell us in 2017 and why so many people are reading the book right now. I do want to get to the phones, and you are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. With me, Glenn Penny. He's a history professor at the University of Iowa. Michael Bougea is here. He's director and professor of Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication. And Matthew is on the line, traveling to Arkansas today. Hi, yeah. Matthew.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Basically, I just wanted to mention how my own experience in 1984. I was in the Marine Corps back in boot camp in 2000. And during boot camp, I broke my leg pretty badly. I was in rehab for 4 months. That was my first time I read 1984. Going into boot camp, I was told by several friends of mine who had been through it that you just got to play the game. You know, listen to what they say, do what they say, just don't take it seriously. And that gets really hard. But after I read the book, I started to see more what the drill instructors, our commanding officers and everything were trying to instill in us. And then even more so as it went on, after, you know, you're taught your history in the Marine Corps, you're taught, you know, all these guys are the greatest things. They did all these wonderful things. And my specific example is Smedley Butler. We're taught this incredible history of Smedley Butler, but we're not taught what the own man said about his own military career at the end in his autobiography, where he said that he was nothing more than a shill for politics, for government, and oil companies. And going through how they treat history in the Marine Corps and how they try to teach it to you without teaching you the overall aspect of it, it made me feel like it was a very Orwellian 1984 type experience, but reading it got me through that experience.
So it got you through that experience. How? I mean, you could see the kinds of influence that were being used.
Being able to mentally, like, stop that, you know, more or less a better word, brainwashing that goes on in boot camp.
Interesting.
It helped me combat it.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for sharing your experience.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Glenn?
I mean, one of the things that reminds me of is the question about information and consciousness raising. I mean, the thing is, we're living in an age in the United States where public funding for education keeps getting cut back and back, and yet it's education that allows people to actually have this consciousness. As he just said, his reading of the book allowed him to take a step back like Neo in the Matrix and see the code, see what was going on, see himself in it, and understand, oh, okay, I understand who's controlling the discourse, and because of that consciousness, he can then make choices.
Well, and that's exactly what George Orwell intended for his audience. I mean, this is a book about becoming a critical thinker, right, Michael?
Yeah, absolutely. And you see that in Julia. You know, everybody talks about Winston Smith being the protagonist of 1984. I don't think he is. I think he's basically a mouthpiece through which Orwell gets to espouse some political ideas. I think Julia really is the heroine because she's a free thinker.
And let's for people who don't know, Julia is a woman with whom Winston has a relationship, a romantic relationship, which of course is completely forbidden by the party. This is something that they do in secret. She's younger than he is. She plays the game of the party. She participates to its fullest extent, but she also finds room for her own free expression.
Yeah, she is one of the reasons that 1984, the last time I looked, was the fifth most banned book in the United States. I don't know if your listeners knew that. I mean, remember, this was written in probably in 1947, 48. It was published in 1949. But the fact of the matter is that Julia is sexually independent. She's a critical thinker. She's creative. The book does have some misogynist content in it, and she overcomes that. You know, the thing about it, though, is she has a fatal flaw, and the fatal flaw is that she loves. And that comes out later in the book. I did want to make a little comment, though, about newspeak. Newspeak is critical in 1984, and it's related to journalism. And it's the idea that language should not expand, that language should contract. So there's no reason to say good and have an antonym be bad. You can say ungood. And if you want to say best, you can say double plus good. And I'm seeing a lot of newspeak in the texting that goes on and in the lack of reading. I'm glad 1984 is on the bestseller list, but reading levels, and not only that, book levels of adults who read books, that is dramatically down. Before I came here, I looked at the latest statistic, and nearly a quarter of American adults had not read a single book in the past year, and the number of non-book readers has nearly tripled since 1978. So what we're losing by not reading, of course, is precisely what you're talking about, Charity, and that is the ability to think critically.
Newspeak is also designed to reduce the ability to think. The Newspeak dictionary that comes out, each edition has fewer words than the edition before it. And that's such a diabolical idea, but it is. It's fascinating to...
Well, we're using MEMS, aren't we? I mean, let's just take a step back for this. I mean, I know we're looking at 1984, but we tend to look at 1984 from a literary perspective. And those who are interested in the book also had a literary education. Keep in mind that the current students at Iowa State or in high schools have had a digital education. They do not have a literary education. And for them, newspeak is the LOLs, it's the MEMS, and their vocabulary is decreasing, not increasing, particularly when compounded with the lack of reading.
Let's get back to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. John is on the line in Ames. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah, I was just wondering what the guests thought of more information being better as related to WikiLeaks and the information that came out about the DNC.
All right, so the question is, if more information is better, isn't it better to have leaks and to know more, theoretically, about what's going on? Michael?
Well, as a journalist, we tell students not to trust leaks. I mean, leaks usually are disseminated for a motive. But we're living in this second-by-second social media world in which a leak gets picked up as truth. Now, the fact of the matter is, and it is a fact, is that there were fake news that played on the political persuasions of people on the left and the right. They dominated social media. You know, and I criticize the mainstream media particularly for not vetting those leaks. They just merely put them out there. I mean, you saw a lot of that throughout the presidential election. And here again, we get the difference between media and journalism. And what we try to do at the Greenlee School, and what many journalists do try to do, is have verifiable fact. But too little of that was done in the fast-paced cycle of the last presidential election coverage.
One of the things that again comes out in 1984 is this rewriting of history. And I'm just curious, because we have in our country, we have a historical record. We have books. We have papers that are, you know, kept forever. But more and more, all of us are getting our information online. And it's pretty simple to, if you've published something online, to go back and edit that and make a change without making a note of a change. Michael, do you have any concerns about that?
I am full of concerns. I mean, I am full of concerns, and unfortunately, I'm not all that optimistic. I mean, the fact of the matter, again, I'm using that phrase because it is a fact, is that people used to read, like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, not on an everyday basis, but if something happened to them, they knew where to go to a definitive source of information. If you don't like the New York Times, put your favorite newspaper or TV station on there for the news. But now, many people don't even know where to go to find the definitive information. Now, what this does, it allows fake news, it allows alternative facts, and you have persuasion rather than what you have is 2 + 2 = 5, as long as 5 aligns with your political views.
Let's get back to the phones. Chris is on the line in Davenport. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Jerry. Great show. I read this book when I was in high school, of course, and I'm 65, and there's a couple points I wanted to make. The scene that has stuck with me is they wanted to get this protagonist to see 4 fingers instead of 3, so they'd hold up 3, and they'd say, well, how many do you see? And he says 4, and they do that again, and then they beat him up and beat him up. And finally they find out what he really hates, and that's rats. So they put a box on his head, and they fill it full of rats, and they do the finger thing. And he finally says what they want him to say, whatever it was for. And they said, oh, no, no, you really don't see it, but hey, you're on your way, guy. And very good. So
what did you
– my life.
Right.
That,
how did that affect you?
Hi. Oh, how does that affect me? Is, you know, I'm going to see how many fingers are there. I don't care what they tell me. I'm going to see what I see. I mean, I'll listen to what they say. But you know, if there's 3 fingers there, there's 3 fingers there, and we've got to say there's 3 fingers there. So real quickly, too, is I think Orwell was dying of TB when he wrote that book, and that also told me, hey, you know, no matter what your circumstances are, you can still carry on and
make a statement.
You know, I agree with this reading thing, because I've tried to use literary allusions with younger people, and they have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience today. Before we run out of time today, I want to turn to something else that happens in the book that I think a lot of people are finding particular political relevance in today, and that is something that is called the daily hate. There is daily hate, there's hate week in the book, and then also Winston tells us about going to see the flicks, the movies, and the movies are all about hate. And when you look at that, Glenn, that part of the book, why do you think that is speaking to people so strongly today?
Oh, people love the rhetoric of hate. I mean, actually, you can watch The House of Cards in the last season. That's what it ended with. When the politicians weren't sure what to do, Kevin Spacey looks at his wife and says, hey, yeah, fear, we can work with that. And, you know, when I teach American history, European history, the history of the 20th century, the end of the Cold War is this point where everyone is completely perplexed. Well, if we don't have an enemy, how do we legitimate spending? How do we legitimate arms projects? How do we legitimate many different things? And how do we legitimate not putting money into other things like education for those proles? Well, it was quite a dilemma. In that case, terrorism was a license, a godsend in a way, because it allowed them to turn their hate towards something new. And that hate comes out again and again and again, and it's just striking. You know, I had a friend of mine tell me that he was really concerned about Europe's move with accepting so many refugees in a country like Germany, without even thinking that, you know, Germany, which brought us National Socialism, is now leading the fight to try and accept refugees into the country, refugees who are not Christian, who are not European. And he acted as if this was a new thing, not recognizing that there are millions of Turks who've been living in Germany and living there very nicely and as part of the society for decades now.
Well, and I read a recent column about reading 1984 in 2017 that was mainly focused on the idea of alternative facts, but not so much on the moments where we are told something that entirely contradicts reality and it's obvious to us, but the dangers of the smaller things that contradict reality. For example, the talking about the travel ban or not allowing refugees to come to the United States from 7 predominantly Muslim countries on the basis that the president is protecting the United States from a threat of terrorism, in spite of the fact, and this is a fact that doesn't get talked about as much, that since the Refugee Act of 1980 was set up and there were procedures for vetting refugees, there has never been a terrorist attack by a refugee in the United States.
If you want to get into the 2 minutes of hate, there'll be people making comments right now about your comment. You know, the fact of the matter is that we're full of comments. We're full of hate on the social media. Take a look at any small political observation. And you made an observation about immigration, and you made an observation about the travel ban. There will be people on social media that will espouse hate based on the slightest provocation. But what was really interesting to me during the presidential election is how the media became the target of 2 minutes of hate. And he'll ask Katie Turr about that. The fact of the matter again, I'm going to keep using the fact of the matter again, is that facts come up on all sides of the political spectrum. And it's not associated with whether you are on the left or whether you are on the right. There are too few media that are in the middle of the objectivity because the margins are too low there. So the media has to take some blame for this as well. We have to be able to get back to the past standards. That's why even in the Greenlee School, we're having some conversations about whether we should require media history again, because it was one of those courses that we let drop off the curriculum because we felt we all knew what the standards were. Now I'm thinking we ought to reexamine media history and why American journalism did rise above many other media systems around the world.
Within 1984, there's a book within a book that lays out exactly
right.
what the party is doing. And you know, just in case you didn't pick up from context what's going on, it lays it out point by point. For people who haven't read this book and aren't going to pick this book up, we only have about a minute left. What do you think, Michael, is the most important thing to take away from 1984?
It's plain and simple. There is actually only one message, and that is master the machine and you master the people.
And Glenn, you're teaching this course this semester. What are you hoping your students are going to take away from this experience?
Well, I hope they learn again that knowledge is power, and that information, there's good and bad information, and the real goal coming out of college is learning to be able to sort between those things.
Glenn Penny, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Glenn Penny is a professor of history at the University of Iowa. Michael Bougea, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Charity.
Michael Bougea is the director and professor of Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication. He also just received the Iowa Newspaper Association's highest honor, the Distinguished Service Award, for his work in journalism education. Talk of Iowa is produced at Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Chelsea Hoy. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.